In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these are the years we refer to as the Golden Age of Radio.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing it.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by Farmers and Mechanic Savings, the century-old bank with seven convenient offices in Middletown, Cromwell, Colchester, and Montville. You'll meet tonight's guest in a moment. Right now, the time is 11:30 at night, and the 24-hour tellers of Farmers and Mechanic Savings Bank can serve you even at this time of night. Get a for money card by opening a checking account or statement savings account, and you can withdraw up to $100 at any hour of the day or night at Cromwell Square, Main Street, and College Street, Middletown, and at the Colchester and Montville offices. It could happen on Friday night that you could suddenly decide to take off Saturday and Sunday to the mountains, the shore, the Cape, New York, or Boston. Aha! You find you're short of bread. So with such sophistication provided by Farmers and Mechanic Savings Bank, you can get $100 in a few minutes at the 24-hour teller. More and more depositors are carrying the great For Money card. A statement savings account tells you every month the total of savings, including the latest interest credited. It's the age of the computer, and Farmers and Mechanics is right up there with the latest modern features. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. And now, your host for the Golden Age of Radio, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is the man with 2,500 hours of old-time radio memories on tape, Ed Corcoran. Ed, how are you tonight?
Very good, Dick.
We've got a good show lined up for our listeners tonight because our guest is Shirley Eggleston. Shirley makes her home in Stamford, Connecticut, and her career goes back to, Shirley, we're not going to say how far back it goes.
Oh, you wouldn't dare.
That just isn't fair. But it does go back, of course, to the golden age of radio, network radio in New York. But Shirley, you had your start in Cleveland, didn't you?
Yes, well, it was that heyday of the amateur, and the children were welcome. And I appeared on many children's radio shows in Cleveland. And I think it's very interesting in the light of local radio being rather popular again today that in that day of radio, local radio was a very important thing and gave a lot of people full-time employment. And those of us that were the amateurs, well, we got $5 twice a year for appearing on a weekly radio show, and I'm sure all of you wouldn't believe me. I know my son does, and he said, I wouldn't have taken it. And, of course, then when the union did come in, and then I think I got paid maybe $20 a show, well, then I thought I was a millionaire. I had arrived.
This was in the days when you actually dressed the part for radio, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, we had studio audiences, and the first show, which I was on, was a junior showboat and was really an amateur hour, and the man who conducted the show was a skipper, and I was his first mate, and I arrived every Saturday in my little white skipper outfit with my little hat, and we had the biggest studio at the WHK, which was the station where it was done, and we put on quite an act.
As a matter of fact, you were billed as the only child commercial announcer in the world. Am I right on that?
That's absolutely correct, and my mother, if she were alive today, would just love you. She, as a matter of fact, I suppose it's debatable, and I'm sure we could find many people, but I did start because the Junior Showboat was sponsored by a local drugstore, mm-hmm. And I would sell each week then. The skipper had to try to think of a way to keep me on the show. He liked me, and he saw that I was a young, ambitious girl of like about 9 or something, and that I wanted to go into show business, and so he wanted to keep me on the show at this $5 twice a year. And at any rate, so he thought, well, she could do the commercial. So every week then, he would write the commercial. He'd present me as the only child commercial announcer in the world. And, you know, he was would say to me, he said, well, now, he said, here's a little girl that wants to talk about, I won't name the product, toothpaste. I don't know if the product's even still around, as a matter of fact. But anyway, he said, now, he said, I would say, now, boys and girls, I want you to know everything the skipper has told you about this toothpaste is absolutely right. It tastes swell, I would say, you know, and I'd go on and do the commercial, you know. And this was how, then, I was the only child commercial announcer in the world, at least on WHK in Cleveland.
Well, very good. There was a very famous personality that was out there at that time, especially in light of television, Elliot Ness. Could you tell us about how you ran into him?
Well, on another radio station, this was the NBC station in Cleveland, we had a junior safety police club. And this was sponsored by a local baking company, and they were very famous in Cleveland, and they were big advertisers from the very early, early days of radio, as I understood it. They used to sponsor Gene and Glenn and Jake and Lena, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of you may have. Well, at any rate, they then sponsored this Junior Safety Police Club, and the idea was, and I think a very, very beautiful idea, that children who had saved a safety club, who had helped another child or helped an adult, helped a blind woman cross the street and saved them from an accident. Well, a tiny incident was then taken and dramatized, and we really had a beautiful writer who was out of Canadian radio, I believe. And then at the end of the drama, the child was brought before the microphone, and this safety police badge was pinned on the child on radio where only the audience could see it, and Elliot Ness was brought in to pin the badge on because he was the assistant safety director for the Cleveland Police Department. So
you did do some drama then.
Oh, yes, very much so. You see, this was really, I was at the Cleveland Playhouse in the Children's Theater, and this was children from all the Cleveland schools, from the whole system, could send two children to this Saturday morning curtain pullers, and they had an opportunity then to work and eventually do children's plays. And from this, I went then in really into radio because I did where there were dramatic shows. There then became a nucleus of children and adults, and we were set up as a studio group who were available to do, who were the theater group, who were, then became the radio actors of Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay, Shirley, let's talk about that most memorable event, I think, in any radio performer's life, his first network show. What was yours?
Well, Bill Stern came to Cleveland to do a show on the way through, obviously. I think he probably had a football game. And so instead of doing it from New York, he came into Cleveland to do it. And on the show was a need for a young teenage actress. And everybody said, well, we know who to get. Get Shirley Eggleston. She's our young actress in town. She's the one, and she wants to go to New York and become an actress. So audition her. And they didn't audition anybody else. I guess Bill didn't have any other alternative. He had me or nobody else. And so it was a very exciting moment. I must admit I was very nervous. And, of course, my mother phoned all my relatives from coast to coast. And I must, you know, this, it is indescribable to when you do get to your first show and you suddenly think, the world is out there and everybody's listening to me and I better not drop the script and I better not flub and I, you know, a nervous stomach and do I have to go to the bathroom and, you know, I mean. But it was very exciting and it, we haven't, believe it or not, on record, I didn't realize I had it.
Ordinarily, we call on Ed for his collection, but I doubt very much, Ed, that you have Shirley Eggleston's first performance. But Shirley does.
And, it's me and my family.
Here's that recording.
Southern California was coached by Howard Jones, who was trying to devise a scheme to beat Notre Dame. Suddenly, an idea came to him. It might work if he could find a little girl who was a great actress. Her job would be to come bursting into the Southern California dressing room when Coach Howard Jones had given her the signal. And then she was to put on a heartbreaking dramatic scene, pleading with the boys to beat Notre Dame. Howard Jones is a fine actress to be convincing, and so he hired the best he could get. Finally came the day of the Notre Dame-Southern California football game. And just as Howard Jones had thought, mighty Notre Dame jumped out into a 2-touchdown lead. At halftime, it looked hopeless for Southern California, when suddenly there was a commotion outside the team's dressing room door. Acting surprised, Howard Jones, the Southern California football coach, opened the door. The young girl ran to the center of the room. She was wildly excited as she began to speak.
Listen, gang, you don't know me, but never mind who I am. I've got a brother who's lying in the hospital listening to the broadcast of this game. He's sick. Very sick. He may not get well. And he thinks Southern California is the greatest university in the world. Don't let him down. Please don't let him down. Please, please.
The players were so dumbfounded, they just stared. A moment later, they went back on the field. Perhaps it was fate. Perhaps it was the girl. But whatever it was, Southern California that day scored a stunning upset by coming from behind in the last few seconds to beat Notre Dame 16-14. The years went by after that, but wise old Howard Jones, coach of Southern California, never forgot that incident. 7 years later, 1938, once again Notre Dame was undefeated. And once again Notre Dame was getting ready to play Southern California. Howard Jones was desperate. He knew no ordinary methods could win. And then he remembered the little girl that he'd hired to inspire his team 7 years before. If he could only find her, it might work again. He did find her, and she agreed to help him again. And that's why on the following Saturday, at halftime during the Notre Dame-Southern California football game, again, there was a commotion once again outside the Southern California dressing room door. Acting surprised again, the Southern California coach opened that door, and the girl again ran to the center of the room.
Listen, gang, you don't know me, but never mind who I am. I've got a brother who's lying sick in the hospital listening to the broadcast of this game. He's sick, very sick. He may not get well. And he thinks Southern California is the greatest universe.
Did that trick work a second time? Well, that night, screaming headlines told a story.
Paper! In your paper, mister! Read all about it! Southern California beat the Notre Dame 13-0!
And so, Southern California had again beaten Notre Dame just as they had 7 years before. All because Howard Jones had hired a clever little actress to put on a dramatic scene. First in 1931, and then again in 1938. Both times she brought him a victory. But maybe you'd like to know who she was. Do you remember in the beginning of the story how Howard Jones looked for a youngster who was a good actress and that he'd hired the best he could find? Well, Howard Jones knew she was a fine actress because he went to the most famous acting family in the world and borrowed their talented daughter. No one recognized her then, for she was unknown. But today, that little girl is recognized as one of the great stars of Hollywood, a truly fine actress. For the little girl who twice inspired Southern California to beat Notre Dame is today the lovely Diana Barrymore.
Oh, and I thought it was Shirley Eggleston.
Well, I didn't want to give it away. Wasn't that kind of exciting?
It was. That really was.
You know, the drama, for me, but I think the drama of the story, I think in retrospect now, the drama that Bill Stern brought to the sports. He's sort of a Howard Cosell, I think, sometimes. I get a little feeling like that.
Well, was it as a result of appearing on Bill's program that you...
Well,
to come to New York?
You know, I had the bug, and so I thought, well, I've been on the network now. I can do it. And so I did come, and Bill, as a matter of fact, was one who introduced me to some people, and also Ben Grauer, the station, WTAM, was an NBC station, and Ben had been through and the station when he was doing programs. And I met him, and I came, and he introduced me to people.
Well, of course, there was a Magic 400 in New York at that time. Referring
yes.
to the actors, of
the
course.
The 400, and of course everybody said, well, now, you know, you realize what you're up against. It's a very difficult situation. Practically nobody works except the 400 who work on the soap operas, and probably will see you back in 6 months. Well, I think I had enough money to last me about 6 months because, as I recall, the first radio show that I got in New York was a 13-week daily radio commercial on Portia Faces Life. And we really did have radio commercials then, you know, in addition. Now everybody thinks television commercials. And people did make a living off of radio commercials. They paid very well. After had a rate for a radio commercial, a daily radio show. And I had exactly $1 left in my savings account.
That really is cutting it close, Shirley.
I played it pretty down to the line.
So, actually, that was your entree into big-time radio then,
through the commercial route. And this, you see, then was to break away from this 400. I thought, all right, so I won't be one of the 400, but there are other ways to be a part of the business and to make a living at it.
One of the shows that you first broke into was Counter Spy, certainly one of the major shows in radio.
Exciting, yes, beautiful people. Don McLaughlin and Mandel Kramer and Bill Sweet directed, and it was we have what, Mod Squad and whatever, but we had Counter Spy.
What was the sponsor?
Well, we had Old Nick Candy Bar and Bit of Honey Candy. And on the record, I can't find Bit of Honey because I was the Bit of Honey girl. I was the honey of a kid. candy bar.
Well, we'll settle for
that. But I settled for Old Nick. I can't find a bit of honey.
Before we continue our counter spy case, my friend Sally here says she has a compliment for us. Well, what is it, Sally?
Well, it's not for you exactly, Mr. Krupp. I think it's really for the Old Nick candy makers. It's from my mother, by the way.
Just what is it she has to say?
Well, you know, Mother is an expert cook.
Oh, yes, indeed. I remember very well. You know, I tasted some of her cake at your house on Christmas Day.
Yes, and she says when we state that Old Nick candy makers are experts, we're exactly right. She says it takes one expert to tell another, and after just one bite of Old Nick, she can tell it was expertly made.
Oh, that's a wonderful compliment, Sally. Expert or not?
Oh, boy.
You were full of the Old Nick all the time.
Full of Old Nick.
But it was as a result of this commercial on Counter Spy that you were given a role in the program.
That's right. Bill Sweet was the director, and later, as you hear on this next record, I believe coming up, you can hear where from a commercial to an actress.
East 3rd Avenue in New York City is a district of small stores, tenement apartment buildings, and cheap rooming houses. At 1:15 one morning, in the doorway of one of the boarding houses, an attractive girl was listening intently to the low, anxious voice of a sailor of the United States Navy.
You know, Carol, I hate to say goodnight to you, but I'm due back aboard ship.
Well, I knew from your letters I'd like you, Alec, but I like even better than I thought I would.
Well, the next time I have shore leave, we have a date, Carol. Huh?
Just as soon as your submarine gets in. Meanwhile, I'm going to be thinking about you a lot, Alec.
Well, good night, Carol. Happy dreams.
Hello, Dr. Varner.
Yes, this is Dr. Varner.
This is Belcher talking. I've been waiting around the boarding house where Carol LaPointe lives to give her new instructions. And she was brought home by a sailor.
Was it an accidental meeting?
I overheard a little they said to each other. They had a regular date, and they made another. You want me to see her?
No, Belcher. I give the orders. I'll enforce the discipline.
Who's that? Who are you? How dare you come into my room?
Don't get out of your bed, Carol, and don't try to turn on the lights.
If you don't leave, I'll scream!
Disobeyed orders, Carol.
Orders? You're the boss, the man we never see.
Except when my orders are ignored.
But I like Alec. We're going to see a lot more of each other. That has nothing to do with you.
You're not meeting anybody anymore. Ever.
Get out! Please! Leave me alone!
Well, there you are again, Shirley Eggleston. You were known as the KK girl, I understand.
That's
you were either kissed or killed.
That's the way it always seemed to turn out.
This is Dick Bertel, along with Ed Corcoran, and our special guest tonight is Shirley Eggleston. And we're recalling Shirley's marvelous career in radio. Shirley, we've got you on some rather offbeat shows. Programs that we've never had the opportunity to air.
Well, I told you. You see, there were others besides the 400.
One of which was Dorothy Dix. Now, before we play this excerpt, perhaps you can tell us a bit about the show.
Well, does anybody, I think Dorothy Dix, do we still know? She's like Ann Landers, perchance. Mm-hmm. I guess we update it to contemporary society. And she gave advice to the lovelorn. And I think the column ran for many, many years, probably back in the 20s, if we want to go back that far. A writer, I believe, her name was Barbara Winthrop, decided to syndicate the show for radio, and you will hear her. She narrates it.
This one, Mr. Ripley, signed simply A Confused Wife, and I don't wonder the poor woman's confused, for when a male ego goes on the rampage, there isn't much we poor females can do but wait out the storm. Here's the letter.
Dear Miss Dix,
I think John and I have been as happy as it's possible for a married couple to be. Even though we have no children, our relationship has been full, satisfying, and mature. John is a professor in a small college, and his colleagues are certain that he will have a brilliant future. For myself, I've never had cause to doubt his superiority until I tried to do a good deed. My older sister wrote that she needed help in sending her daughter Sandra through school, so I offered the girl a home with John and me for her full 4 years of college. Almost as soon as Sandra moved in, I began to notice her preoccupation with John, and I mentioned it to him.
Oh, Beth, it's utterly absurd. Your niece is just young.
I think she's developing a full-fledged crush. It must be your graying temples. You do look distinguished, dear.
Oh, Beth, I'm a stodgy college professor. An 18-year-old like Sandra probably thinks I'm about ready for the cemetery.
I hardly think so, John.
I'll be 40 next month.
Darling, you were never handsomer.
Oh, nonsense, Beth.
But gradually, Miss Dix, I began to notice that it was John who seemed to be making occasions for him and Sandra to be together. One evening, I'd gone up to bed early with a headache. Instead of coming up to our room to read, John stayed downstairs with Sandra. I couldn't sleep, and after an hour or so, I slipped down the back stairs to get a glass of milk. I could hear John and Sandra in the study.
I just live for them. I simply do, John. You always seem to understand me, even when I don't understand myself. Sometimes when I think about how stupid the boys in school are by comparison, I just can't bear them. You're so different, John.
You mean so old?
Oh, no, John, how could you possibly think I meant that? It's just that... Well, John, I guess I've never known anyone like you before. Anyone so wonderful.
Well, you were a terror, weren't you, in those days?
Ooh. Didn't realize I'd been that bad. I always tell my son I was the goody-goody girl. See, I can't have him listen to that record, then, can I?
Well, there were so many different shows, surely, that you appeared in. But, Ed, we're coming up to a title that is totally unfamiliar to me. I've never heard of this show.
Judy and Jill, and it surprised me. I guess it referred to a clothing company, didn't it?
That's right. You mean you didn't hear that show? That's one that got past you.
I'm afraid it did.
Well, to the best of my memory at this point, Johnny Long was apparently had some kind of musical show, and I didn't really remember Johnny Long.
Left-handed violin player.
And they had Judy and Jill dresses, and they auditioned us to be who was going to be the Judy and Jill. And I don't really think they ever picked a Judy and Jill. I think we auditioned each and every on the show, and each week there was another Judy and Jill, and I happened to find this record that I did have. It kind of combines that time of the 40s with your popular bands, along with how a sponsor was working through their product and how they were trying to keep, you know, a total kind of commitment to contemporary society, I guess you would call it today.
This is Judy and Jill.
Would you mind throwing me a downbeat?
Hey, wait a minute! Hold it! Stop! Are you kidding? This is my solo! Getting me all embarrassed and everything in front of everybody? Read your music. Johnny, let's start from the drum solo. Hold it, hold it! Have you got music on this?
Sure.
Let me see it. Can you read it?
Yes, sirree.
All right, you see what it says right there? It says you start at letter A, go to J, skip K, and go to L.
I'm sorry, Patio.
What a peasant.
that drummer is wonderful. He's so cute.
Why don't you pay some attention to me, Judy?
Why, Johnny, all my life I've been saving my kisses for a man like you.
Well, look out, honey, or you'll lose the savings of a lifetime.
Fellows, it's getting late, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, do you think it's too late?
Oh, no.
We could
go
to the Roadside Tavern.
Oh, no, too late.
Now, wait a minute, fellas. This has gone far enough.
Yes, far enough.
Tom, this has gone far enough.
Yeah, mighty fur.
Look, let's get the facts straight. You invite us to your house. We pay for the cab fare here.
True.
We buy our own corsage.
You're so right, ma'am.
We even buy you boutonnieres.
Oh, so generous of you.
Well, you might at least show some appreciation.
Well, we're here, aren't we?
Mighty big of you. You know, Jill, we should have gone out with Phil and Jimmy instead.
That would have been better than these ungrateful characters.
Wait a minute. What does Phil mean to you, Judy?
Well, the dictionary says Phil means a lover of horses.
And what does Jimmy mean to you, Jill?
Jimmy means beloved.
But girls, what did Johnny and Tom mean to you?
Johnny and Tom better mean business. Let's go, fellas.
That's a great sound of that band,
isn't
too.
Isn't that
it?
Terrific?
Johnny Long.
You know,
yeah,
gee,
they call them a Mickey Mouse band. It didn't sound like it to me, Dick.
Surely this was done, of course, in front of a live audience.
Oh, yes. We were in one of the big theaters. It was a Mutual Broadcasting Theater, as I recall. And they had to have tickets to get in, and everybody. It was a very exciting time.
Well, surely, one of the things that we were commenting on during the course of that broadcast was the suggestive dialogue for the 40s.
And a friend of mine was a censor at CBS, and I see he retired a year or two ago, and I think it's probably just as well. If it was that bad then, just think what he's combating now.
We have a program coming up now, Ed, which was perhaps one of the earliest sociological dramas ever in mass communications.
Yes, in fact, it was the only one, Dick, as far as I know.
Well, this was a show that was on WQXR in New York on one night and then rebroadcast over the entire Mutual network on another night. It was called I Was a Convict, and it was about real people and their problems. And what were some of those problems, Shirley?
Well, of course, here's one show that could be revived, and probably television could do it naturally better than we did it on radio, perhaps, although maybe not. It was people who were convicts, and they told their story. And when I listened to this record, first it's introduced as a sociological drama, I think at the beginning you hear it rather ominously. Then I found that the part I was playing was a girl who took dope. Now, that wasn't 1967. I think it was 1947. So, what's new?
But there is something rather unusual about this, because they were referred to in this particular program not as drug users, but as what?
Drug eaters.
And why were they using this particular term, do you recall?
You see, I was, far removed, I guess, from all the real problems of the world. I only played what the problems were, I guess, And I suppose maybe that's, in a way, why I've wandered into the new field that I'm in journalism. I guess maybe I felt I needed to get closer to some of these problems that I had been acting out.
Let's listen now, then, to that recording of I Was a Convict.
WQXR presents the sociological drama I Was a Convict, heard every Sunday night at 7:30. Believing that crime takes only a moment to commit but requires a young lifetime to prepare, WQXR, in cooperation with the Society for the Prevention of Crime and with the Mutual Broadcasting System, presents I Was a Convict. Tonight we bring you the transcribed dramatization of an event in a girl's life, and an interview with a woman to whom it happened.
I was 13 when it started. Does that shock you? It don't bother me. Not now, anyway. You look back on things sometimes and wonder whether they could have been different. I used to do that, too. But I don't bother so much now. I suppose it would have been different if Dad hadn't sent me away to a finishing school. He sent me pretty far away. You see, Dad wanted me to be a lady. So I went to this finishing school. And I was scared and lonely. And then I met Jimmy. He was about 18. And nice. So when he asked me to go to the movies, I said, sure.
How do you like going to the movies, Joan?
Oh, I love it. I just love it. I'm so glad you asked me.
I'm glad, too. Only...
Only what?
Only I wish it could have been at night.
Now, Jimmy, you know Miss Pritchard doesn't allow girls to go to the movies at night.
I know, but going in the afternoon is... Well, it's kid stuff.
I think it's wonderful.
Wait here a second, will you, Joan? I want to run in and get some candy. Movies aren't any fun without candy.
Sure.
I'll be right back.
We went to the movies. I ate the candy, a lot of it. Jimmy didn't, though. He said he just got it for me. We went to the movies a couple of more times. Jimmy was nice. He never tried to get fresh. Just put his arm around me. Nice-like. He always had the candy, though. And then, one morning after I'd been with Jimmy to the movies, I woke up feeling bad. Awful bad.
Joan, what's the matter, Joanie?
Oh, I don't know, Alice. I feel funny. Sort of sickish. I'm perspiring all over. I don't know what's the matter with me.
I'll tell Miss Pritchard, huh?
Oh, no, Alice, please don't. I'll be all right.
But why ever not?
Well, because I went to the movies yesterday with Jimmy and I ate some candy. Miss Pritchard will say that was it, and she won't let me go to the movies again. Oh, I feel awful.
What are you going to do?
Get Jimmy. Tell him I feel bad, and I'll meet him outside after school.
All right, Joanie. Anything you say.
Hello, Joanie. Alice told me you weren't feeling so good.
Oh, I don't. There must have been something wrong with that candy yesterday.
Nothing wrong with the candy, Joanie. Here, I brought some more for you.
Oh, I don't want any.
Eat it. Here. It'll do you good.
Oh, all right.
Now, how's that? Feeling a little better already, aren't you?
You're right. I do feel much better. Gee, that's funny.
No, it isn't.
What do you mean? Why should the candy make me feel better?
Because you're eating dope.
What?
Dope. This candy's a spike. They've been loaded with it.
Oh, I'll spit it out. I won't eat anymore. Why did you give it to me? I don't want to see you again. I'll never eat another candy, never.
Now, calm down and listen to me. You'll see me again. See me because you have to. Because you won't feel good. You're hooked, Joan. You're a dope eater. You're going to need the stuff to make you feel good.
I'll tell Miss Pritchard.
What? Did you like dope? It'll make nice writing home for your father. He sent you here to become a lady.
I don't feel well. I feel dizzy.
Sure you do. And there wasn't much in that last piece of candy either.
Give me another piece of candy, Jimmy.
Mm-hmm. Sure. In a minute. You're going to need this stuff, Joan. You're going to need it bad. And I'm going to introduce you to a woman who's going to tell you how to get it.
Wow. You were hooked and you didn't know.
Ooh.
It, huh?
Wow. It's still pretty powerful, isn't it, when you listen to it and realize... The problem is not just of the recent 5 or 6 years. It's been around a long time.
But this must have been extremely shocking for the radio audience, having been exposed to it for the first time.
I think, as you can see in this Jack Gould column in the New York Times, there was an awareness that I was a convict, was trying to do something quite different. And in my present occupation, I'm concerned reporting about drug education. And now I understand the kids say, well, we don't need to have as much factual information. We want to know what to do, amazingly enough, like what this situation was in this drama. What do I do when peer pressure comes upon me and I am asked to take something? And that's exactly what this girl was facing a long time ago.
Shirley Eggleston, we'll get back to your story right after this message.
Just as the melody lingers on long after the song has been played, so it is with the kind of personal banking you get at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. You appreciate all the things being done for you. It may not be noticeably apparent at first, but it grows on you. Modern personal banking services and more. The extra friendliness of the staff, not just the tellers, but the whole Farmers and Mechanics staff. Branch managers, loan officers, even the president, who is right there on the first floor with his door always open. Good old-fashioned service is a little rare in today's modern computer age, but you'll really find it at Farmers and Mechanics. And if you need computer age service at 2 o'clock in the morning, on a Sunday afternoon, or even on a holiday, you get it at Farmers and Mechanics 24-hour teller at four offices, Cromwell Square, Main and College Streets, and in Colchester and Montville. Join the happy customers of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank, where the feeling of real friendliness lingers on. You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio on WKSS, Hartford, Meriden. And once again, your host, Dick Bertel.
Well, Shirley, we're going to have to get you back into the soap opera realm. And you did appear in many shows, one of which is coming up right now.
Yes, this is one which one of my favorites, Dick. It's called Whispering Streets, and Kathy Lewis, she was on the show, too.
That's right. Yes, this was went on an ABC, and it was on every morning, and some shows ran for 2 or 3 days, some for a week, some for one day, sometimes a continuing drama, but they had a good audience. I think it was really one of those. It was like My True Story. This was similar to it.
Mm-hmm. And there was a big name then, well, it wasn't so big then, but he's very big today, who was on the show with you, Ross Martin.
Oh, yes. And you must play this record, or my son won't let me in the door when I arrive home. It is with Ross Martin. And this was as Ross was on his way up in the radio business, and he was going into theater, as we all were dabbling in theater, too, and television. However, I think very briefly I'll try to tell the story of Ross. I'm sure he can tell it better than I can. This is how I remember him telling me. I said, Ross, what are you doing in the acting business? And he said, well, you know, I was a junior executive with a liquor company, I won't name it. And he said, they were promoting me, and they told me I was going to become very big, very, very, very high up in the company, he said. But I looked at the men 20 years ahead for they were going to finally put me. And then I looked at what was happening a few years beyond that, and I found what happened was that they were getting fired. It was the end. And he said, I decided that that wasn't the path I wanted to take. And I think Ross was from Washington, D.C. I may be wrong. And he said, I decided I'd always wanted to be an actor. And I just decided I'd throw in the sponge and I'd come to New York. And so Ross came to New York, and we certainly know the story of how well he has done. And he was a very exciting actor to work with. Some actors prefer just to work, make love to the microphone or whatever, you know. But never Ross. I mean, just hold your hand. He held your hand. You had to hold on the script with the other hand and whatever. You know, we were pretty much, you were really pretty much right almost on camera with Ross.
All right, here's Whispering Streets with Ross Martin and Shirley Eggleston.
Come in.
Parker, may I have a word with... Well, where is he, Miss Harris?
He's out. He'll be away for about an hour and a half.
Oh, darn the luck. I have a long-distance call coming in. I've got to get Mr. Parker's approval before I commit myself.
Well, maybe I can help you. I am Mr. Parker's confidential secretary.
Well, it's a Fitright Shoe Company. It has to do with a patent.
Oh, Fitright Shoe Company. Mm-hmm. You said a patent.
Yes, new type of synthetic rubber heel. Plastic, really.
Uh-huh.
Say, you wear common-sense shoes, Miss Harris. You ought to know about... Well, at least I thought you wore common-sense shoes.
Oh, these aren't... You see, this morning, on my way to the office...
They're very pretty slippers. Well, a girl with feet like yours shouldn't wear common-sense shoes. I agree with you.
But these shoes... Look, I can tell you anything you want to know about Fitright, Mr. Davis. I have some notes that Mr. Parker gave me. I think they'll clarify your thinking. I'm sure Mr. Parker will want you to crack down on them if they're getting out of hand. After all, they need us. We don't need them.
Oh, well, as long as you've given me the go-ahead, Miss Harris. My women would want to wear common-sense shoes anyway. You've been hiding your light under a bushel, Miss Harris.
Oh, skip it.
For the nonce, yes. Be seeing you.
He never looked at me before. Never. I used to dream. Oh, it's only these shoes. These horrible, deceitful shoes. Well, Tim will have my own back again in a few minutes. And who is it?
Yeah, me, Miss Harris.
Oh, thank goodness. Come on in, Tim. Did you get... Where are they?
Well, I went to the cobbler, Miss Harris, but... Well, I'm afraid you'll have to make out with those slippers you're wearing for a while.
What do you mean?
Well, the girl they belong to, she's gone out of town, Miss Harris.
Oh.
She took yours wrapped up in paper and put them right in her satchel. Oh. The cobbler says she'll be madder than you are when she finds out.
Oh, madder than I am. I could kill him with my bare hands.
I'm awful sorry, Miss Harris.
Oh, it isn't your fault, Tim. It's just a mistake. You're not to blame it.
Oh, hi, Tim.
Hi, Mr. Davis.
Miss Harris?
Yes, what is it, Mr. Davis?
My call came through.
Good.
I told him where they got off in three neat sentences and hung up. Miss Harris, I wonder if you'll have lunch with me.
It's all right, Timothy. You may go.
Okay, Miss Harris.
I hoped you had something to tell me about the Fit Right Shoe Company. You never asked me to luncheon before.
Somehow you're different today. Those slippers gave me the idea.
Oh, I thought it was like gold me.
Not just yet. You've been taking dictation all morning and all afternoon from old Parker.
Mr. Parker. Go of me.
It's Mr. Davis who has you in his arms. Slight mistake on your part.
I was merely suggesting that you show respect to your superior.
The deuce with my superior. Will you take a letter, Miss Harris?
I'm not your secretary.
Well, I'm going to dictate a letter anyhow for the sheer thrill of it. It'll go something like this. Dear Miss Harris, I didn't recognize your latent possibilities until I saw your little feet in their lovely silver slippers. And the ankles above them. So I'm about to suggest that we make up for lost time.
How dare you?
Well, now you're going Victorian on me. You're as Victorian as horsehair sofas and houses with lace work along the roof. And black cotton stockings. I'm glad you don't wear them.
Thanks.
Well, we'll return the letter. And if you'll go dancing with me tonight...
I don't dance.
Well, I'm a very fine teacher. I bet I could teach you a lot of things, Ellen. How long is it since anybody's kissed you?
If you... Oh, don't. No.
Well, I'm glad you're beginning to relax.
Well, I forgot to sign that very important voucher, Mr. Well, flirtation's going on right under my nose.
Well, this is rather more than a flirtation, sir.
Really? I assume that the voucher's on my desk, Miss Harris. The one to be signed, I mean.
That's right, Mr. Parker. It's quite in order. And now, if you want my resignation, you may have it.
You know, I said earlier that you were either kissed or killed, but there was a third aspect of your career.
I got fired. Forgot about it.
And who played the organ on Whispering
Well, Prince? That was Rosa Rio, and of course I understand you've had her, and she's done all of her marvelous
That's
tricks.
That's right. As a matter of fact, it was Rosa who gave us your address so that we could find you, Shirley.
Well, you see, we did True Story, Whispering Streets, Modern Romances. This was all the many exciting things that we did, and Rosa, you know, brought so much to the show. There's just no denying that she was... You know, musically as much and very important entity as the actors. It was just, she was marvelous. She had just such spontaneity and she just brilliant feel for not just music, but for the whole drama, which of course is what, you know, is needed in radio where, well, like somebody said, you know, you have to see with your ears.
Well, we have covered your radio career rather well, I thought, but you were also on the stage, and perhaps you might just say a few words about this early venture into off-Broadway theater. It was called New Stages, wasn't it, Shirley?
Yes, and I know I've got to be brief, and it's pretty hard to be brief. We did last for 2 years. It was a group of radio actors, and mainly it was such names as Richard Kiley, Tony Randall, Martin Balsam, Joyce Van Patten. New Stages, our desire was that we would offer good theater. It would be done by professional people who wanted to do something else with their careers than just be in radio. And I think, you know, our aim was great. personality and financial problems brought disaster to us. Where New Stages has never been written up. Now that I am in the writing field, I really feel this is one thing that I owe to the profession, is to tell the story of New Stages, because we really were the forerunner of what is now Off-Broadway. It really was something that unfortunately, as I say, is always in the theater. It's a financial problem. And radio actors, let's face it, most of them in radio, there was a degree of security there. So, of course, after New Stages, television was already in the wings, and at every radio studio, there was always around the corner a little television office. And occasionally, you know, there was a little television studio over at Dumont, and you'd say, you know, the word would get around, hey, you better go over there and audition, you know. They got those cameras, and television's really here, whether you like it or not. And it grew so quickly. It's always easier, like history, you know, after the history is written, to see what was happening. I think there was no question that there were some actors who knew this was the end. Their career was ending. I think for most of us who had had theater background at any rate, and then done radio and done these other things, we knew we had to go into television.
Well, radio was dying, but it made one last gasp on the network, didn't it?
Yes, it certainly did.
What was the name of the show?
Crime Letter from Dan Dodge. And what it really was, this was a last gasp. It was a network show. So they figured, well, how can we save radio? Well, let's take a successful radio show. We'll give it a new name, however. And then we'll get a sponsor. We'll sell it into the network. And we'll get a star on it. And maybe this will save radio. Yes, we were all working at television then, however, we knew.
Visualizing Home Permanent and White Rain, the wonderful new lotion shampoo that leaves your hair sunshine bright, bring you transcribed a crime letter from Dan Dodge. Dan Dodge, portrayed by motion picture and stage star Myron McCormick. Dan Dodge, the most daring private eye, reveals to you his most private crime letter.
Could this be?
It is.
You mean it's...
Shout it, girl. Say it proudly for all the world to hear.
Daniel D. Dodge Detective Agency.
Ah, that is a nice ring.
Oh, Dan, we're back in business again. You're perfectly...
My old Laring loathes himself.
Oh, they released you from the mental hospital, the rest home. Oh, Dan, your nervous breakdown is officially repaired. You're perfectly...
By the narrowest margins, I escaped the hot tub, the cold tub, the shock treatment, and 17 graded lessons in beef stringing, sweetheart.
Oh, Dan, I'm so relieved. I feared the worst.
With good reason, Susie, but be of good cheer. I'm turning in my draped model straitjacket and starting home with an utterly unbelievable report entitled,
What, Dan?
There you have me. I thought of the Roman home caper, but it sounds Italian. The rambling bungalow has architectural connotations. The hothouse caper has a nice ring, but still and again, the only flowers involved were the forget-me-nots I embroidered on a doily while incarcerated here. So, for the moment, let's just tag this the preposterous caper.
Greetings, little one. Well, don't give me the fish eye. I'm perfectly normal. See? My discharge papers.
Well, all right, Dan.
Hey, what's all this stuff?
Oh, I was just leaving when the phone rang, Dan. I was going to visit you.
Daddy Dimple, paper doll cut out. Little Wonder, cowboy color book. Flopsy, Mopsy, and Peter go camping.
Just something for you to do, Dan.
Oh, take them back. On second thought, put them in the file cabinet. In this racket, those are something that sooner or later you can use. Are you ready, my little prom girl?
Yes, sir.
To Elmo Follinsby. Dear Elmo, it has been a happy, happy day. I picked up a fast $50 watching the presents at a wedding reception and two deadbeat clients had come through with checks. In short, things were going entirely too well, but who was I to ask questions? So I put my feet on the desk, opened the paper, stayed on page one only long enough to get my usual headache, and was turning to the sports section when something caught my eye. Escaped lunatic seeks private detective, it said. But the strange part was yet to come.
Mary, this is Susie. Look, I'm doing one of Dan's reports. Now, be a good girl and tell me how to spell preposterous.
And listen, Mary, I don't want Dan to know he can use a word that throws me. So if he comes back, I'll change the subject and call you later. Uh-huh. P-R...
Well, Susie, back to Elmo and the preposterous caper.
That's P-R-O-M, prom. It's really a swell permanent. Stringiest end curls you ever saw. And prom neutralizes itself automatically. Cuts out all that messy bother of a separate neutralizer. Don't forget how to spell it, Mary. P-R-O-M. I'll call you back for sure.
So that's the crime letter from Dan Dodge.
Well, sort of get smart or something. Maybe we were today, huh? It was fun.
Well, at any rate, your career went on, but of course in another medium, in the medium of television.
Yes, and from television, I guess I got a social conscience, and I became a newspaper reporter.
And you were with the Stamford Advocate for many years.
That's
now,
right.
With a weekly newspaper in my old hometown of Darien.
That's right, Darien, Connecticut.
Well, Shirley Eggleston, it's been great fun sharing your career, your memories, and your mother's scrapbook with you.
Bless mothers.
I do hope you'll come back and see us again. Well, until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
When is a bank a savings bank? The answer to that question is when the word savings is part of the name, like Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank in Middletown, Cromwell, Colchester, and Montville. Now there is a venerable century-old savings bank that features savings as their principal service to you, helping you to save frequently, helping you to save successfully. Any kind of savings account that suits your way of saving is yours. Theirs is a total effort, everything from an instant savings account, which you can open with only $5, to a six-month money market certificate that pays the highest rate and yield. $10,000 minimum, and the rate changes every week. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has such a variety of savings accounts and certificates that you can safely assume they have your kind of a savings account. And assume something else, that the interest rates paid on your savings are the highest permitted by law. Saturday hours at 6 branch offices and 24-hour teller service at the Cromwell Square office, Main and College Street in Middletown, Colchester and Montville offices. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing in your time.
The Golden Age of Radio was brought to you tonight by Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank, serving you for over a century. Seven offices in Middletown, Cromwell, Colchester, and Montville.
The Golden Age of Radio was edited and produced by Brian Hartnett. The program was engineered by Bob Sherrago and Dick French. This is Al Terzi.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Kame, the mild beauty soap.